was expected that taxation would eventually eliminate poverty. But surprisingly, this did not happen. 19th century economist Thomas Malthus criticized governments for trying to replace the church. He argued that the matter should be left to the private sector to be effective. Malthus's view was in fact a small part of the capitalist idea. The approach that said governments should not directly intervene in affairs, even charitable ones. As capitalism expanded, charities evolved according to Malthus's vision. Capitalism created a new class of wealthy individuals, and those individuals established their own charities. They became members of an informal club. The Club of Philanthropic Capitalists.
The Queen Mother went to the Royal Commonwealth Society to receive checks for the Freedom from Hunger campaign. Well-known people already there, awaiting Her Majesty, included Jesse Matthews and Millie Martin. Little Belinda Giles and Julius Adimola of Uganda presented a bouquet. Presented by Sir Philip Water was a cheque for more than £10,000, the amount collected at ABC Cinemas. Alderman Barber of the Cinematograph Exhibitors Association. Housewives, evidently led by Lady Hume, handed over the first of 20 cheques they had subscribed. It's good to have royal support for this excellent cause, the Freedom from Hunger campaign.
In the early 20th century, Andrew Carnegie and later in the same century, Bill Gates shared similar views on poverty. Carnegie, who like Gates was a billionaire of his time, affirmed that millionaires are trustees of the poor. 100 years later, when Gates founded his charity, he thought much like Carnegie. Both argued that taxation could not curb poverty. They believed the world's main problem was economic inequality, and the solution was the establishment of charities. Perhaps this is why charities have been exempted from paying taxes.
So Congress in the 1969 Tax Act said there are two kinds of charities. There's public charities, a soup kitchen or a school or a hospital, we trust them, and they can do kind of what they want. And there are private foundations, and we're going to watch them like the hawk, like the Ford Foundation or the Rockefeller Foundation. So let's imagine that you're a donor and you bought a house on Lake Tahoe in 1962 for $100,000. It's now worth $5 million. And you want to create a charitable entity that you can make charitable gifts from. If you put that into a private foundation, the only tax deduction you would get would be the $100,000 that you paid for over 50 years ago. If you put it into a donor advised fund, you would actually get a $5 million charitable deduction because it's considered part of the public charity that technically controls the donor advised fund.
Just recently, I was on a flight traveling from Beijing back to Toronto. This man sat next to me on the plane, and we ended up chatting about how some of the ideas from the nonprofit world could apply to the for-profit world in his business. And he said, that's the most interesting business model I ever heard.
Of course, the issue was not only tax exemption. They also had to generate income, because the logic of capitalism and the free market demanded it.
So we welcome school groups here, typically before COVID, two school groups a day, morning and afternoon. And this is part of the tour, that we would welcome school groups in to learn about how it all started, and with the idea that it would hopefully inspire them to start their own journey of what they wanted to change the world.
Within this logic, a charity was like any other business, a trade in which one could invest and achieve profitability.
We Day is generosity. We Day is the movement of our time.
two centuries, the wealthy turned charities into economic enterprises, institutions whose survival, like any other business, depended on supply and demand.
How many kids do you think have come by to see what you're showing me?
Just thousands and thousands and thousands. We had school bus parking right here. This place was built for kids.
Yeah. Yay! We did.
Almost in a way, it was kind of like the Facebook of social change. Like, when you're on Facebook, when you're on social media, you think I'm the consumer, but you're not. You're the product. In many ways, we realized that day the students are the product. For the corporate partners that were coming in on We Day, it was a chance for the organization to say, look at the access we have to all these future consumers that, you know, that you're now are going to be exposed to your brand.
In practice, a charity was no different from a Ford factory or Coca-Cola. Of course, unlike those companies, they did not pay taxes, but revenue, meaning donations, was crucial. To increase income, philanthropists had to imitate large corporations. Companies that knew well had to make profits through a path called the advertising industry.
Look closely. Really closely. Deep into the eyes of a child.
Advertising, like the sorcerers of the Middle Ages, tempted people. It told them, if you need something, buy it. If you don't need anything, buy it anyway. Ford sold cars, Coca-Cola sold soda, and charities sold the pleasant feeling of altruism. Advertising helped charities market their products and raise demand. Yet this was difficult because customers of this trade had to be convinced to pay money in exchange for nothing tangible. The media knew how powerful images could be. If photographs could change the course of the Vietnam War, they could do anything, provided someone stays the scene and captured the right moment. The subject could be a small child, perhaps accompanied by a mother. In these images, tattered clothing mattered as much as a dirty environment. Lighting had to highlight the child's innocence and the mother's suffering. All these elements combined to create the final product, an image suitable for attracting donations. None of these pictures were entirely false, but the issue was which image, in which context, reached which audience. That was what the advertising industry excelled at. These images could change many things about the lives of the poor, though not in a positive direction.
Whatever I will be. Allah's love has no limits. Allah's love has no boundaries. For every raindrop that falls, for every ray of sunshine, for everything is under His control. You cannot see Allah, you cannot touch Allah, but you can feel Allah. He is there in every tear that falls, in every smile that shows. Allah is all around us. I am whatever I may be, but Allah has already planned my destiny.
Good night to all our listeners. You are tuned in to Iran Radio, broadcasting from Tehran. I'm your presenter for the next hour. Stay with us into the early hours of this morning. We'll start off this hour's lineup with Islamic laws. The program focuses on Islamic Sharia law and adopts a practical approach. After that, we have insights into the Holy Quran. The program presents a short exegesis and explanation of the ayahs of the Holy Quran. And our final program this hour is Leader's Speech. The program presents an English translation of a selection of the statements and speeches of the Honorable Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Stay with us for the next hour.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, my guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me on.
You're welcome. Well, we have been discussing some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature for quite a while now, and we'd like to continue along the same line. Let me ask you this question, Sheikh. What are the general Islamic laws or Sharia laws regarding a kind of mixing or gash? This is what the terminology in fact holds in the transactions and trade, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei, of course.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. There is no doubt that cheating and deception or using any tactics to deceive the customer is forbidden.
Yes.
Actually, to play a trick on someone and to sell goods which are defective,
right,
is not permissible. And in the event that the buyer comes to know that the property or the good or the item he has purchased,
yes,
is defective, he has the option and the right to cancel the transaction,
mm-hmm,
and return the good and get his money back.
Right. Well, these are the general laws, right?
No, yeah,
regarding
of course.
The
any dishonest practices are forbidden in Islam.
Mm.
It's not permissible to conduct any such practices, whether the customer is Muslim or non-Muslim,
mm-hmm,
okay? It is necessary for every vendor or any seller to be honest and to show to be trustworthy and to tell if there is any defect in the item or in the good or utensil or whatever he sells. If there is any defect, he should frankly tell the other person,
right,
that this is the defect, and if you want to purchase it, you should purchase with previous knowledge and understanding of the defect.
How about dishonest, in fact, people or individuals who are involved in a kind of transaction? Like, for example, you're going to buy something from someone and they don't inform you of the technical defects, as you mentioned.
Right.
So can you, give them, for example, something of a lesser, let's say, value, like shortchange the person or something like that by being dishonest as a kind of reaction to the dishonest or unscrupulous, for example, transaction that they held for you?
You're right. The person who sells, he is not entitled to the money he
right.
receives, because the person who buys, he buys it as something which is not, which is flawless, which is completely perfect,
mm-hmm.
and it is sound, and there's no defect in it.
Right.
So he buys it with that intention. While the buyer, the seller knows that there is such a defect. It's if for example, he sells a cow,
right.
and the cow suffers from an illness,
right.
or suffers from some kind of problem,
mm-hmm.
and he does not reveal the
right.
truth to mm-hmm. to the buyer. So the buyer has two options here. One is the khiyar al haywan, then the option for returning the animal
yes.
and getting his money back, and the other is of course the khiyar or the option for the defect.
Mm.
Okay, khiyar al aib is the option for the defect.
What can he do?
When he has the right to either get the, adjust the amount.
Right.
Take the money, portion of the money
right.
back, and go ahead and use the product or the animal, or else he can return the product or whatever he is
has
defective.
Purchased.
Yes, he has purchased to the seller.
Thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Well, Sheikh Javid, what is the rule regarding forgetting, for example, the content or the text that we are required to read, for example, during qunut in a prayer?
Well, qunut is not obligatory per se.
Mm-hmm.
And if a person forgets any zikr of the qunut, he can change the zikr and recite another zikr. Another
right.
zikr, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Any dua that you recite, whether it is in Farsi or in Arabic, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
The religious authorities have allowed to recite,
right.
Have allowed to recite any zikr.
Right.
So qunut in itself is not wajib, let alone the zikr or the askar which we might want to recite in it.
Mm, I see. How about, in fact, mispronunciation in the prayer? Does it matter whether, for example, this pronunciation takes place in or during recommended prayer or obligatory ones?
Okay. Mispronunciation, it's a defect, it's a problem. And the duty-bound, the mukallaf, is supposed to work on improving his pronunciation.
Mm-hmm.
So he has to make every effort to pronounce as correctly as possible. and at the same time he must make sure that he improves his pronunciation. Okay, wrong pronunciation gives a wrong meaning, gives a wrong sense, yes, and it denotes something else. So if a person knows that his pronunciation is wrong, he must improve it. And if a person knows that, for example, a certain prayer leader does not pronounce the letters and words of the prayer correctly, he cannot stand behind him and offer his prayers with Jama'ah.
Right.
He must offer his prayers individually in that case. So the thing is that if a person is in a position and able to improve his pronunciation, he must do so.
I see.
And he must do his best to pronounce the letters as correctly as possible. Of course, he has to consult people who know how to pronounce.
Yes. Sheikh Javid, you know, we are not talking about the Middle Easterns or Middle Easterners or Muslims or Arabs who would know, like by default, for example, the correct pronunciation of the Arabic terms or terminologies when it comes especially to obligatory rituals,
right,
such as the prayers. We are talking about, for example, people coming back actually from different walks of life, different backgrounds, and different linguistic backgrounds, actually.
Right.
All right. For example, it's pretty hard. Let me give you a very clear case.
Right.
It's pretty hard for English-speaking people to pronounce kh sound, for example.
Right.
Right. Which is prevalent in Arabic.
Yes.
A lot. So, or the differences between, for example, fa and sa and the and
sod
da
and
sod, zod. You know, all of these sounds in Arabic are even somehow difficult, I guess, for the Arabs to pronounce.
Yeah.
Not to mention, or let alone, for example, people with different other languages, basically. So it's pretty hard, basically, for them to pronounce the correct requirement when it comes to pronunciation of those words, right?
Yes. So the thing is that one should do as far as it lies within him to improve his pronunciation. And God does not obligate a person beyond his capacity.
Right.
Okay, you are honest in your pronunciation and you are trying your best. God knows the truth. And if possible, even for a newly converted, he is supposed to improve his pronunciation. I know his pronunciation is going to be, it is in the very beginning. It is not
perfect.
Perfect,
yes.
Okay, he might not be able to pronounce K, H as K,
right,
while he pronounces it as K. Okay,
yes.
God knows the truth.
I see.
And he knows how sincere you are, but you are also trying and trying to, but that doesn't mean that you should keep praying because you are not able to pronounce prayers. Okay, you should at the same time, even people who are deaf and dumb, you know, people who cannot speak, they are supposed to pray. They cannot even pronounce any words.
Okay.
They cannot speak any words, the dumb especially. Okay, they are supposed to use gestures instead of making words.
Thank you very much, Shaykh Javid. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back and continue our program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, do people have to, make a ghusl or ablution after miscarriage?
Of course they should. It is wajib for ladies who experience miscarriage to do ghusl. There are two ghusl that becomes obligatory on a lady who experiences miscarriage.
Right.
One is the ghusl for touching a dead body, because the fetus comes into contact with her body.
Yes.
The child is born dead,
mm.
and that is ghusl for touching a dead body. And the second ghusl is ghusl for the postnatal bleeding, the bleeding that occurs, okay? This is called ghusl nifas,
mm.
okay? So she should do two major ablutions. One is ghusl mas for a dead body, and then one is ghusl nifas. And of course, if she performs one ghusl with the intention of both of them, it would be sufficient.
Mm.
She is not supposed to repeat the ghusl and do it again twice.
I see. Thank you very much, Sheikh. I think that is the case, or that rule applies to every kind of ghusl, right?
Yes,
imagine that you can just have one, you know, ghusl with lots of niyyah, right?
Yeah, of
intentions.
Course. Right.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Sawid. Thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to your own program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio, in which we try to delve into some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى و دین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be a verse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough. Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, hello and welcome. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll have a look at some of the contents of Surah Ankabut. So now let's listen to the 45th verse of this chapter.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
أُتْلُ مَا أُوحِيَ إِلَيْكَ مِنَ الْكِتَابِ وَأَقِمِ الصَّلَاةِ إِنَّ الصَّلَاةَ تَنْهَى عَنِ الْفَحْشَاءِ وَالْمُنْكَرِ وَلَذِكْرُ اللَّهِ أَكْبَرُ وَاللَّهُ يَعْلَمُ مَا تَصْنَعُونَ.
Recite, O Muhammad, what has been revealed to you of the book, and establish prayer. Indeed, prayer prohibits immorality and wrongdoing, and the remembrance of Allah is greater, and Allah knows that which you do.
So, in the previous episode, if you may remember and you may have been with us, we said that since the Prophet of Islam is now taking this burden, and he has to carry this burden of prophethood, he has got this heavy responsibility, and he is informed by the Almighty Allah of this responsibility, he is also recommended and ordered actually to take help from these two strengthening sources. What are they? Utlu ma uhiya min al-kitab. Recite whatever is revealed to you of the book. Wa aqim as-salah. And establish the prayer. So, why is he to do it? Because the Holy Quran mentioned in the previous verses the stories of other nations and how their situation turned out in the very end. The Holy Quran is informing the Prophet that you have this responsibility for your people, for your nation, to help them reach salvation. And in your path, in your journey, you need two important things: the recitation of the Quran, and also وَأَقِمِ الصَّلَاةِ, and establish the prayer. So, of course, since the nature of prayer reminds man the strongest restraining factor, that is, the firm belief in origin and resurrection, it has an impedimental effect from the indecency and evil. That's why it says إِنَّ الصَّلَاةَ تَنْهَى عَنِ الْفَحْشَاءِ وَالْمُنْكَرِ. Surely, and verily, this salah moves away and keeps away the people from indecency and evil. So, he who stands in prayer says Allahu Akbar. He calls Allah higher than and beyond everything. He remembers His bounties. He praises, He glorifies Him. He praises Him, subhanahu wa ta'ala, for His mercifulness and compassionateness. He remembers the day of His judgment. He confesses His actually servitude to Him. He seeks for His help. He seeks His help, and he asks Him, subhanahu wa ta'ala, to lead him to the straight way. And he refuges to Him for the path of those inflicted with His wrath and those who have gone astray. غَيْرِ الْمَغْضُوبِ عَلَيْهِمْ وَلَا الضَّالِّينَ, the verse says. So no doubt, there will appear a movement in the heart, a and spirit of such a person toward the truth, toward purity and piety.
والله يعلم ما تصنعون.
So that's the power of salah. That's the power of establishing prayer. أقم الصلاة إن الصلاة تنهى عن الفحشاء والمنكر. And we understand for a salah, for a prayer to be an absolute true form of prayer, we must see these results, we must see these positive effects. The one who establishes prayer, he certifies to the oneness of the Almighty Allah. He attests to the prophecy of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and he sends salutations to his actually prophet, his messenger. He asks Almighty Allah in supplication, and the Almighty Allah will appoint him among the righteous servants. All these things create a wave of spirituality in man, and this wave can be considered as barrier against sins. That's one of the aspects why إن الصلاة تنهى عن الفحشاء والمنكر. Indeed, prayer keeps one away from indecency and evil. But we have also this this ending part of the verse, وَلَذِكْرُ اللَّهِ أَكْبَرُ. Certainly the remembrance of Allah is greater. وَاللَّهُ يَعْلَمُ مَا تَصْنَعُونَ. Allah knows what you do. So this salat is a form of dhikr and remembrance. And this salah is repeated several times in a day and night. And when the man gets up in the morning, he is engaging in salat, in the remembrance of the Almighty Allah. And at midday, when he is busy with his material life, he suddenly hears the sound of Allahu Akbar by Muaddin, and then he seizes his current programs and hastens to go to him, subhanahu wa ta'ala. And even at the end of the day and at the beginning of the night, before man goes to bed to rest, he prattles with him. He makes his heart the center of the rays of the light of the Almighty. And moreover, while he's preparing himself for establishing prayer, he washes himself. The man has to purify himself, sending away any unlawful things and anger from him. And then it is time to go toward him, subhanahu wa ta'ala. Brothers and sisters, we have got more to discuss regarding this 45th verse of Surah An-Kabut, so stay with us. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until the next program, take care.
Things always work for me.
Every day is a lesson. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
The following is part of the speech delivered on April 27th, 2017 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the Supreme Leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the participants of the 34th International Quran Competitions. We had seen examples of such meetings up close in Tehran, Mashhad, and other cities, and we had heard about similar meetings in other cities. A group of people would gather together, recite the Quran, and that was it. Memorizing the Quran, reciting it in a continuous manner, and promoting Quranic teachings were very rare. However, the revolution helped us get close to the Quran. It familiarized us with the Quran. Today, we are proud that we are interested in and fervent with the Quran. We are proud that our youth are interested in the Quran. Today, if it is announced that there is going to be a Quranic meeting in every city of our country, youth will rush towards it in large numbers. You witness Quranic meetings in all cities and in various gatherings. They pour into these meetings and they listen to the Quran. These are things that have taken place thanks to the revolution and Islam.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Those who are interested in the Quran and in charge of Quranic affairs should not abandon this field. You should pursue this task seriously. You should not say that because you have reached such and such points, it is over now. This is not the case. Working on the Holy Quran is infinite. We should endeavor and work very hard. Everyone should endeavor and work in order to establish a close relationship with the Quran. All our family members, our youth, and our people should get close to the Quran. Memorizing the Quran is a source of getting close to it. Repeating such meetings is a source of getting close to the Quran. Getting close to the Quran has many advantages and benefits because it will familiarize us with those above-mentioned concepts, God willing. I hope that Allah the Exalted rewards you. I hope that He bestows His blessings and His mercy on those who have taken a lot of trouble on this path in the course of many years. Some of them have passed away. I hope that God will raise their position, and I hope that He preserves for our society those who are still alive. I hope that God associates our magnanimous Imam, who opened this path with his pure ancestors and with the followers of the Quran on Judgment Day. I hope that He makes us be among the followers of the Quran, God willing. Greetings be upon you, and Allah's mercy and blessings.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. I want to thank you. I want to thank you.
good night to all our listeners. You are tuned into Iran Radio, broadcasting from Tehran. I'm your presenter for the next hour. And here are some interesting facts about the Holy Quran I invite you to listen to. Surah Yasin is considered the heart of the Quran for its tremendous benefits for the believer. The best drink according to Quran is milk. In the Quran, Allah also describes the rivers of milk in the heaven. The best food according to Quran is honey, which cures several problems and is the sweetest gift to humans from Allah. Normally, the Quran declares Friday as the most blessed day of the week. The month of Ramadan is the best month of the year, and the night of Qadr has been described as a night better than 1,000 months. Its significance is described in Surah Al-Qadr. We start this hour's lineup with our varied radio productions feature. Then we have today's special daily mixed format program that deals with various Islamic and Iranian occasions. And our final program this hour will be our radio productions feature. Stay with us for the next hour.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Audio Shelf. Today I'm going to read to you parts of the book Unwithering Flames, published by Green Palm Publications, about Shahid Abbas Babai. Please stay tuned. Abbas Babai, born December 5, 1950, assigned to pilot training in the U.S., 1969 to 1972, married to Malihe Hikmat, August 26, 1975, martyred on August 6, 1987, Sardasht. Proposal. The winter of the year he returned from America, he came to our house. I was 16 at that time. He came over quite late, and although my parents had a habit of going to bed early, they stayed up until midnight to talk to him. I had a rough idea of what they were talking about, but I pretended like I didn't know. At midnight, after Abbas left, my grandparents went into the room, closed the door behind them, and started talking to my parents. I guessed correctly. I stood behind the door and listened in on their conversation. From what I understood, Abbas had come to ask permission to marry me, and since my parents didn't want me to find out, they had all gone into that room. My mother was against it. She had told him that she was completely against a marriage within the family and also didn't want me to get married so young. She had also told him that since he was in the army, he would have to travel to different cities and it would be difficult for him to stay in one place for long. My mother approached these issues very logically back then. She was a teacher. My parents were not blood related, and my mother didn't welcome the prospect of such marriages even more than my father. Naturally, he was against the concept as well. But Abbas had adamantly told them that if this proposal didn't work out, he would throw himself out of a plane. They told him that threatening them was not going to do him any favors. Then they talked more, and in the end, my mother said, "What if Maliha herself opposes this marriage? If she is against this marriage, then I will choose her husband, provide her dowry myself, and then I will disappear from her life forever," he retorted. When my parents saw how stubborn Abbas was, they told him to leave for now and come back with his parents. And so he did. Before leaving, he had asked them to speak to me and see what my perspective was regarding the marriage.
This is Audio Shelf on IRIB English Radio. Our website is iranradio.ir.
always there for me. I didn't know what the right decision was, even though I knew him since childhood. We grew up together. Abbas was my cousin. My father was his mother's brother. He was the third child in the family, after an older brother and sister, and I was the eldest child in my family. We grew up in the same neighborhood. Our houses were on the same street, at the end of which was the school that I went to. Their house was a 5-minute walk from our house. Most nights, we all had dinner together at our house. The house actually belonged to our grandparents, who also lived with us. It was an old and spacious house. There was a pool in the center of the yard, surrounded by a veranda and adjoining rooms. I was just a child back then, and Abbas was 7 years older than me. He usually came to our house every day. My father, who was a knowledgeable man, helped him with his studies. Abbas had become like one of his sons. My father had told him to make a key for himself so he could come and go more easily. Abbas had seemingly become a part of our immediate family. He had a bicycle that he had traveled with all around Qazvin. He would pass by, park his bicycle by our door, and check to see if there was anything he could help us with. He would do my painting homework and write my papers for me. Other than my mother, he was the only one that my infant sister warmed up to. My parents had arranged a private taxi to take my brother to and from school, back when these kind of things weren't as common. Abbas told my parents that it wasn't necessary and he could take him to and from school with his bicycle. He joked and said my brother was handsome and he wanted my brother with him so everybody would stare at them.
Stories about famous martyrs of Iran in Audio Shelf, only on IRIB English Radio. Our website is iranradio.ir.
Something different about him. Even as a kid, I could tell that his actions were different from those around him, at least as far as I could see. Outside our homes, I wasn't aware of his actions. The situation in our house was such that leaving the house for anything other than school was deemed odd. I knew all of Abbas's family and acquaintances. They were my family too, but back then, despite his young age, he did things that even I hadn't seen older members of our family do. He would take accountability for his own actions. In their home, they would ask him why he always ran out of notebooks and pens, but in actuality, he would give them away. He liked doing these kind of things. For instance, sometimes he went to school early in the morning to sweep the floor clean so that the principal didn't have any excuse to fire the school's caretaker who suffered from backaches. From early on, it was obvious that he had a good rapport with the elderly and lonely people. On Thursdays, when we went to the cemetery, we would see he had found and befriended one of these men who recited Quran verses over graves. I was still in high school when he finished his university studies. When I grew older, my mother told me about some issues that girls my age would face. For example, being harassed by boys. My mother and I were very close, and I could talk to her about anything.